Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a rough road ahead for the U.S. economy, says economist Paul Krugman, and time right now to spend massively on federal stimulus, deficits be damned. Caution is folly, argues the 2008 Nobel Prize winner in economics and New York Times columnist. Deficit worries, he writes today, are misplaced. Krugman was a fierce critic of President George W. Bush. Now he's urging President-elect Obama to pull out all the stops with huge federal money, a new deal to get the economy back on track. Be bolder than FDR, he says, or else. This hour, On Point economist Paul Krugman with advice for a new president. You can join the conversation. What was the talk on the economy around your Thanksgiving table? Is it time for a flood of federal spending? Do you worry about the deficit? What's your question for 2008 Nobel Prize winner in economics, Paul Krugman? Paul Krugman joins us now from New York. He's a New York Times columnist, Princeton economist, and this year's Nobel Prize winner in economics. In his 1999 book, The Return of Depression Economics, he warned that 90s economic meltdowns in Asia and Latin America were warnings for America. Unfortunately, it turns out he was right. He's out with a new updated version titled The Return of Depression Economics and the Crisis of 2008. Paul Krugman, welcome.
Tom.
You're still worried about the economy going into free fall, even now after all the billions that have been put out there? Free fall?
It sure looks like free fall. All the numbers that have been coming out are, you know, really scary. I mean, we've got the worst. We have the new report on manufacturing, which is the worst since 1981, which was the worst recession since the Great Depression back then. And there was a difference. Then interest rates were quite high, and you could fight it by cutting interest rates. Right now, the interest rates that, you know, you can cut are basically at zero. So we are in deep yogurt, as the first President Bush used to say.
How are we going to know if we're going deeper into the yogurt or moving out? What are you looking for now?
Well, I mean, I'm looking at the usual gauges. I mean, we're looking at employment. We're looking at manufacturing, which is not the core of the economy anymore, but is still a really good indicator. And, basically we know that this economy is headed down quite fast, that in spite of the attempts that have been made to heal the financial markets, they're still pretty grievously wounded, and that there just isn't enough demand out there. There isn't enough spending to maintain employment. This is depression economics, as I said in my book. It doesn't mean there's a depression, but we've got depression-type economic problems.
We'll talk a lot about how you would like to see that free fall arrested, but if it's not, paint the picture for us. I mean, what are we up against? What does free fall look like if it goes on?
Well, okay. If it goes on, then we're probably looking at unemployment rates reaching 9 or 10% by the end of next year, maybe higher. That means something like 10 million or more Americans who are currently not in poverty falling into poverty. It means something like probably 6 million people falling into what we call extreme poverty, which is less than half the poverty line or lower, so really desperate straits. It means very large numbers of people losing health insurance, because most people's health insurance is tied to their jobs. So if they lose the jobs or are forced into a worse job, health insurance goes. You know, we're really talking about more or less catastrophic impacts on tens of millions of Americans. So this is not good. Let me put it that way. We're not talking about people selling apples on the street just yet, but we're talking about something which is really pretty bad.
You're talking about the response being your prescription: pull out all the stops, be bolder than FDR, a new deal. What does that mean?
Okay, I mean, when we talk about FDR, we think of the New Deal spending vast sums of money, but actually, although it was more than any other president, potential president at the time would have done, it wasn't that big relative to the economy. And there were pullback. So in 1937, when the economy was still, by normal standards, quite depressed, FDR was convinced that now was the time to start being responsible again. So he cut WPA employment in half and raised taxes, and the economy slid back into a sort of reprise of the initial fall at the beginning of the Great Depression. So he was pretty cautious, partly because the economics wasn't there. Right? The people had not yet achieved
the economic understanding, the sort of scholarly work around Great Depressions. We were in the middle of it.
That's right. People were trying to figure the thing out. And, of course, it's not as if we have perfect understanding even now. If we did, we wouldn't have got into this mess. But so the point was that FDR offers lessons in what not to do as well as to do. And the big lesson right now is you got to do enough, because there really isn't anything to fall back on if the government spending is not enough. If the government spending falls short and still leaves the economy sinking, normally you'd say, well, okay, Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve can cut interest rates, except he can't because they're hard up against zero, so he can't do anything there. So you really have to go big enough to really turn this thing around, or it's going to be quite ugly.
What does that look like? President Obama's naming his economics team last week, moving into national security this week. A lot of people are going to be whispering in his ear. You've got a megaphone, and you've been using it. But in the next, 3 months, 6 months, a year, describe the scale of intervention, of stimulus spending action that you're envisioning.
Well, my back of the envelope a few weeks ago said that we need 4% of GDP. Which is $600 billion. Now, the news has gotten worse since then, so that now looks like a lowball estimate. But you got to do a huge amount of stuff. What can that consist of? Best estimates are that there's something like $350 billion of infrastructure spending. That's roads, bridges, rail lines, things that can be gone online pretty quickly, more or less ready to go. So that can be a big part of it. You can provide a lot of aid to state and local governments because, while the federal government is trying to at least gearing up to increase spending to help us deal with this, a lot of state and local governments are being forced to cut back, which is a really bad thing. You can provide aid to the unemployed. There will be more unemployed people. The aid we're giving is very stingy. It expires too soon. We can give more. And those people will probably spend the money if they receive it. And you can go on down the list. But those are, I think, aid to people in distress, aid to state and local governments, and infrastructure spending are going to be the core of it. And it's going to be a lot of stuff.
If $600 billion is no longer enough, what's your back of the envelope saying now? Is it a trillion now? Is it more?
At this point, I would say give me $600 or $700 billion, and that probably isn't enough to produce a full recovery, but it's at least enough to greatly break the impact. It is true that it gets a little hard. It gets a little hard to come up with fast-acting projects that get much bigger than that, but let's at least do that.
I don't even know what this means exactly anymore, but let me ask it anyway. Do we have the money?
No, there's a real issue, right? Even the U.S. government can't borrow unlimited amounts. So if we're talking – and we may be talking at a budget deficit of $1 trillion next year, maybe more than that. So it's going to be a lot of borrowing. Now, the trillion here, trillion there, and soon you're talking about real money. The way I like to think of it is this. Advanced countries that have stable governments – I think we're still one of those, though at some points in recent years I've wondered about that. But advanced countries with stable governments have an enormous capacity to raise revenue. And if they have a credible reputation that they will do what's necessary to pay their debts in the long run, they can go a long way into debt before they find themselves unable to borrow. The United States had debts that were 125% of GDP. At the end of World War II. That's more than double what it's got now. Countries, even countries that of questionable stability like Belgium have had debts of 100% of GDP without being shunned by the bond market. So we got a fair bit of running room, not unlimited but enough. So if we do the kinds of things I'm talking about for 1 year, 2 years, even 3 years, we shouldn't have a problem. If it's more than that, then we're starting to be in an even worse position than I think we'll be.
We'll look at that. You must have. You may have read George Will over the weekend. He's talking kind of about you, and he says a new deal would vindicate pessimists. And he's talking, I guess, conservatives there who say that history is not one damn thing after another. It's the same damn thing over and over. The idea that going back, trying a new deal, just, he says, forget about it. You know, there's the interpretation that it didn't work the first time and that this is bad medicine now. And it's not only Republicans with cold feet, sweaty palms about that deficit it would require.
Sure. I mean, people are nervous. Now, a lot of what, you know, a lot of the conservative line about the New Deal is basically bunk. What can you say? There's a lot of stuff that's based on treating 1938 as the year that defines the New Deal. And that's the year when Roosevelt gave up on his spending programs. In 37, he decided to go orthodox and produced a recession in 38. And then conservatives say, see, New Deal type spending doesn't work because unemployment went up in 38. Mm. A lot of it is also just, you know, poor failure to understand what the nature of the problem was. But it is true that the two relevant examples, FDR in the 30s and Japan in the 90s, used public works spending, and while you can argue that it helped, it certainly didn't in either case bring them out of the slump. Mm-hmm. But you can then, if you look at it more closely, you discover they really didn't do it on an adequate scale in each case. And it was in the end a public works program that ended the Great Depression, a very large public works program known as World War II. So this, you know, we don't have to do it on that scale, I hope, this time. The question for the conservatives here is, you know, what is your answer? Is you really saying that what we need to do is let the free market work, let wages fall, liquidate farmers, liquidate the workers, as
Mellon,
Herbert
Andrew
Hoover's
Mellon.
We have a pretty good idea of what needs to be done, and we should act on that because the consequences of not acting would be terrible.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with economist, New York Times columnist, and Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman about the global economic crisis, what got us into it, and what may get us out. A little advice for a new president and maybe everybody else on the economy here this hour. His book, all refreshed and back with a big view of what's going on right now, is The Return of Depression Economics and the Crisis of 2008. He joins us from New York. Paul, as you write, the idea was that we were never going to face this again, that we had learned from a very, very deep and painful, dangerous experience, and we were never going to go back to a risk of the Great Depression. But here we are. Why?
Well, I think the core of it is the fact that we recreated the banking risks of 75 years ago. You know, what had happened after the Great Depression was, or during the Great Depression, was people looked at the enormous bank runs. It was really a banking collapse that dealt the fatal blow, not the stock market crash, and, you know, put up an elaborate safety net for the banks. So mm-hmm. bank deposits were insured. Banks themselves were regulated, required to hold capital, required to have reserves, and had special lines of credit with the Federal Reserve. So all of this was designed to prevent stuff from happening. Now, we all see the movie It's a Wonderful Life, which mm-hmm. shows the bank run. And the thing is, at the time that the movie was made, that couldn't have happened. That bank run was something that happened in the 30s, but by the time It's a Wonderful Life was made, mm-hmm. There were all kinds of guarantees to prevent that from happening. Fine. And for 60 years, you know, everything seemed calm. What happened, though, was we gradually grew ourselves a second banking system, a system largely designed to do an end run around all those regulations. So we had all of these things, asset-backed commercial paper, auction rate securities, various kinds of things that effectively were doing the job of banking, were giving people what they thought was ready cash but using that money to finance longer-term investments. Mm. But all of it outside the regulatory framework, all of it with no safety net. So people call that the shadow banking system or the parallel banking system. And by the eve of this crisis, it was bigger than the traditional banking system. And then it collapsed. And it's basically a 21st century version of the bank runs at the beginning of the 1930s. You know, instead of crowds of people in the street pounding on bank doors, we have hordes of people in cyberspace clicking on their mouses. Mm. But it's effectively the same kind of thing. The triggering event was the collapse of the great housing bubble. But what turned that event into the catastrophe we now see is the fact that we had sort of not while not watching it, we had grown up this extremely vulnerable financial system.
I think a lot of people are confused about how and whether that really gets reformed because, you know, with hedge funds and all the rest, it still seems off in an unregulated, informal, sort of free world. And that's been championed. We've had many economists on this show who earlier said we're getting great efficiencies out of this. This is the march of progress on the economy. Do you see it being reined in? Can it be? Has it become integral to our global economic system? What do you do with that shadow banking system?
I think it's possible. I mean, never underestimate the ability of modern governments to get things to regulate if they put their minds to it. I mean, people who say we can't do this, I'm sure that we would have had, if there was a 1925 version of this program on air, you would have had economists explain that you just can't regulate banks. There'll always be a way around. And in fact, it was possible. So we have a rough idea of what it would involve. And the details, bank regulation is an arcane, difficult field, but necessary. We know that we need to have capital requirements. We know that we need to have restrictions on the kinds of investments that you can make if you're financing them with short-term assets that can have to be rolled over continuously. It's going to be tough. It's going to require a lot of lawyers as well as a lot of experts on regulation, and it's going to require international cooperation because if somebody can set up a shadow banking system in Dubai that promises people higher returns and convinces them they don't need to worry about risks, then it undermines the whole effort. So you have to have a lot of stuff. But we do this, you know, on conventional banks. We do actually have international agreements. Basel II is this agreement that regulates bank capital everywhere. So it can be done. It's going to be very elaborate and hard. But, you know, the prospect of another Great Depression concentrates the mind.
Do you think that the economic team that Barack Obama has put together is likely to want to do it? You've got Lawrence Summers in there, who was with Clinton in the 90s. Timothy Geithner, who's been in the middle of things in New York. Both of these guys with their links to Robert Rubin at the head of Citigroup, which just got bailed out. Is this a team likely to implement the kind of changes in that shadow banking system you're talking about?
Well, Geithner actually was quite early in warning about the dangers. Now, he did it in the kind of ambiguous multiple interpretations way that central bankers always talk. So you can, you know, he wasn't as forthright as one might have liked, and that was the nature of his job. But I think he understood this even before everything fell apart, and so I'm optimistic. Summers was a champion of financial deregulation in the 90s, but I think he's a very smart guy, and I think he's learned a lot. I mean, as have we all, right? I've probably always been to the left of Summers, but he and I have on these issues both moved further left than we were 10 years ago because of the enormity of the thing. So, I mean, mostly what you need is people who are open-minded and smart, and that for sure is true of the members of the new Obama team.
Let's turn to our callers, if I may. Let's get a call from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and Gene. Gene, you're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Hello, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I have a major concern with the real estate portion of this financial crisis that we're in. I mean, even back in, I can remember back in the middle of 2004 when in California, where I was living at the time, 46% of the mortgages were said to be interest only. That combined with adjustable rate mortgages that are out there in numbers that I'm not aware of, when they go to have to refinance and their properties are well below what the market was when they purchased them, that to me seems something that the elephant in the room in many instances. How will you think that can be resolved? Because that to me it speaks to refrigerators, carpeting. I mean, there are so many residual impacts that it kind of mirrors the auto industry issue that we're going to be confronting this week.
Paul Krugman, how do we deal with, get out of that housing bubble?
Well, I mean, you can try to mitigate. I mean, the main answer is there's a lot of losses that cannot be avoided there. It can be mitigated. We can have initiatives that try to find you give all everybody concerned an incentive to try and work these things out, because it turns out that foreclosing on a house is a very expensive proposition. It typically not only hurts the person who's kicked out of the house, but typically costs an enormous amount to the lender as well. But there's only so much you can do there. And the truth is that housing prices are still probably 10 or 15% at least above where they have to go eventually. And as they drop to realistic levels, a lot of people are going to end up defaulting on their mortgages. The main thing you can try to do is to minimize the secondary consequences. What's happened is that the losses on mortgages, which then translates through into losses on all kinds of assets that are backed by those mortgages, have depleted the capital of our financial system, left many institutions in deep trouble. What we need to do is recapitalize the financial system. Basically, taxpayer money is going to be used to to put enough cash in that these firms can operate. It'll have to. That should be done, you know, not for free. It should be done in return for a share in ownership.
So we've been doing that, right? Hundreds and hundreds
although
of billions.
Although we've been doing it in a funny way. We've been doing it with the government doing as much as it can not to actually get any of the privileges that come with ownership. So they've been insisting on – they've been trying to get shares with no voting rights. It's not clear that – you know, at this point, enough of that. We need to be serious. I mean, in effect – look, in effect, what we're going to end up doing – this is a prediction. It's also, I think, the right thing is we're going to end up with a temporary partial nationalization of the financial system. Temporary because nobody really wants the government to be in the business of being the economy's banker for an extended period of time. But the right now what we need to do is keep the system operating, keep it running, and then, you know, regrow it, reprivatize it as things calm down. But that's what you do. The home thing, you know, this was an enormous – basically $8 trillion of fictitious wealth was created by the housing bubble. That's going away. At least $1 trillion of that is falling – of those losses are falling on financial institutions, and filling that $1 trillion hole is something we have to do.
And at the homeowner level, are you in favor of some kind of intervention there to bail individuals out, prop up the value of their homes or their – at least their financing to keep them?
Propping up the value of the homes, no. I mean, you basically – that's like trying to tell the tide not to come in. Mm-hmm. The home values are going to drop down to normal – a normal relationship to incomes, rents, all of that. So you can't really do that. Helping them stay in the homes, working out deals, yes. I mean, yes, there is a problem. This does to some extent reward irresponsibility. But you know, you don't want to get too hung up on that. In many cases, people were sold were misled by the lenders. There was an awful lot of fraud involved. You know, this is what people were saying right at the beginning. The most complicated, the most confusing home mortgages were being foisted on the people least able to make sense of these things, the lower income people who were, you know, there was a lot of predation basically. And I think that's a partial excuse for the moral hazard issue. Sorry, moral hazard being, you know, letting people off the hook for the consequence of their own actions. And also, look, everybody or not everybody, but many, many people behave badly in the crazy years of the middle, crazy middle years of this decade. We can't punish them all. And it's in all of our interest to provide at least some recompense for what happened.
Gene, thanks for calling. Let's go to Dubuque, Iowa, and Marty. Hi, Marty. You're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And to your distinguished guest, greetings from the great Midwest here.
Greetings.
I grew up in a community where most of our families made fairly decent working man wages. Wages were good. There was a strong labor movement in this area back in the old days, and Saul Bellow, the great novelist, once wrote of Dubuque, Iowa as being a beautiful, sprawling community, and that was in 1956. But wages nowadays, folks, are just absolutely deplorable around here. They've gone backwards. I think the average working man makes less money than what like my dad might have been making in 1975. You know what I mean? Really bad, and I'm just kind of wondering what types of ideas that we might have going forward to increase that working wage, because as you know, that's probably what's at the heart of this mortgage crisis. People just aren't being paid enough money to make the payments.
Marty, let us pick it up. Paul Krugman, what do you say? Wages. The voice from Dubuque wants to know, where does that go and how do they factor in? Do wages have to take the same hit that housing takes, or do you see something else?
No, not at all. I mean, housing is, that's an asset that got overvalued. Wages, now this is a longer-term problem, and it's, I don't know if it's at the core of the housing crisis, but it's at the core of a lot of the trouble that the country's in, which is that fewer and fewer people are making a middle-class income. And what can we do about that? And there are several things that we know how to do. One of them is universal health care. That turns out to do a lot, not just in making sure that everybody's got access to adequate health care, but also in terms of relieving the pressure. If you look at, for example, the auto companies and why they're in so much trouble, there's a lot of bad decisions, but there's also the fact that unlike auto companies anywhere else in the world, they have to bear the burden of paying for health insurance for their workers. They could continue to pay better wages if health insurance was something that was universal in this country. You can talk about labor organization. Now, we know that the unions don't have much bargaining power, if any, in the auto industry now because of international competition. But there are large parts of the U.S. economy that could be unionized or could at least be giving wages sufficient to make unions not seem like such an attractive option. Why isn't Walmart more than a million employees? Why isn't it unionized? And the answer, of course, we've had a very hostile political climate to unions. If you look at the decline of the union movement in the United States, it has much less to do with impersonal market forces than many people think, and a lot to do with the fact that starting with Ronald Reagan, employers were basically given more or less impunity for union busting efforts. So there are other things we could try to do. We can obviously – it's always a good thing to try and have better education so we have a more skilled workforce. There are probably a number of other things we can do to make the lot of working Americans better. But things to start with, I think, are health care and a better climate for labor movement
organization. Let me ask you about the economics of that. I mean, who wouldn't want higher wages for Marty and everybody else? But we've heard a lot in recent weeks about how Detroit's in so much trouble, the big three, and yet we've got non-union auto manufacturers in this country who are doing okay, who are not on the verge of bankruptcy. You're going to have people who say, well, we're up against foreign competition now. Their wages are lower. This is just the new hard reality. You're voting for accepting, I guess, hard realities on the housing front. Is it possible that we have to just take the hit on the wage front? Is that just a reality too, or is that too dreary?
Well, talk about foreign competition and their wages are lower. That's actually not true, right? It's not true that
Wages are higher in Mexico and China and India.
But remember, there's an auto industry in Germany which has been exporting pretty successfully, and they pay higher wages than we do.
Right.
It's not that simple. And part of the issue is in fact that we don't have uniform standards at this point. By the way, the wages paid in the big three to new workers, and the wages paid in the transplant. The foreign auto companies are not that different. The big difference is healthcare costs, and that's something we can actually do something about. That's something we can address with policy. We cannot simply dictate. Without limit. You can't say, everybody's going to be paid $40 an hour. That can't happen. But history tells us that there's actually quite a lot you can do. History in the form of what happened after the New Deal, which pushed up wages for a lot of workers. And what followed after World War II was a great economic boom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times columnist, Princeton economist, Paul Krugman, winner of the 2008 Nobel Prize for Economics, author of The Return of Depression Economics and the Crisis of 2008. Let's get a call from Victoria in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Victoria, you're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. My question has to do with consumer spending and the economy. It seems that a lot of measures of economic health have to do with how much American consumers especially are spending. And it seems the last few years have been a period of unprecedented affluence in this country and in other parts of the world, too, really. And I wonder if maybe we haven't exceeded our capacity for spending and are not finding that much of the stuff that we've been buying clutters not just our houses and closets but our minds as well. And I'm wondering if there is not a way for the economy to sort of downsize with relationship to that kind of consumerism without destroying the world.
That's a great question, Victoria. Thank you, Paul. I think a lot of people's minds are wrestling with this. Is it all about gearing back up and, you know, into high gear and let's go shopping? Is there another way to have maybe a different balance and economic health? You hear Victoria's question.
Yeah, no, Victoria has a good point, although let me say a word on behalf of the American consumer. You know, it's not all frivolities. It's not... most people are not living high on the hog. There's spectacularly important work by Elizabeth Warren, who's a bankruptcy expert at Harvard, where she looked into, you know, what does lead people into piling up debt that leads them to bankruptcy. And it turns out it's not splurging on their credit cards and going and buying lots of useless consumer goods. It's mostly overreaching, trying to buy a house in a good school district so that their kids can have a decent education. You don't want to sneer at these, you know, over consuming Americans. There's not nearly as much of that, people in the middle class, working Americans, as legend would have it. What is true is that we've been living beyond our means. For whatever reason, it's a mixture of a lot of spending by well-off people. Taking out second mortgages on their homes and so on, we've been having basically a zero savings rate for quite a while, and that can't go on. And saving has to go back up. People have to live within their means. Trouble is, what takes the place of that consumer spending in the economy? Now, it should be investment. It should be investment for the future, but it's not easy to get investment going at a time when the financial markets have basically collapsed and financing isn't there. So there's a very difficult transition period. And if you want, the reason that I'm pushing for these big fiscal stimulus packages with an emphasis on investment, on infrastructure, is to fill that gap until we get things under control. It's a very difficult to get to a sounder level of consumption all at once. Lots of us have been quoting St. Augustine lately, you know, grant me chastity and continence, but not yet. It's just this is coming on too fast, and we need to bridge the gap until it's over.
Paul, let's just stick with this for a second, though, because among economists out there of great prominence, you're one of the most progressive. And here you've got a caller who's kind of getting at this issue of, okay, maybe it's not all frivolity, the spending, but I think whether you're liberal or conservative, people have this sense that, can we keep this merry-go-round up? Does this growth work? Maybe it's for important things, and yet we use a quarter of the world's, oil and energy, and people wondering at a moment like this, such a crunch moment, if this is a sustainable way that we've had. So you're Mr. Progressive when it comes to economics. Is there another way, or is it just growth and consumption of whatever kind? Is that just what economics means?
Well, okay. I mean, my great idol is John Maynard Keynes, the economist you have to understand to make any sense of what's going on now. And he did write an essay called Economic Prospects for Our Grandchildren, in which he looked forward to a day when basically people would have enough and that where they would no longer – they really wouldn't care very much about having a bit more stuff. And he's talking about how wonderful it would be when we could have a more moral society because people would no longer be so acquisitive. And he thought that day might arise when you had incomes that were sort of kind of what we have now in the United States. It turns out that there are still things that we can argue about whether all the consumption we undertake is a good thing. And there's a very fine line there between serious analysis and just being a snob and not approving of the ordinary mm-hmm. people's mm-hmm. tastes, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a very tricky line to, mm-hmm. to negotiate. And so it's one reason why economists, including myself, are very cautious about that sort of thing. There's no question that more goods, more stuff adds less to your life as you have more of it. That there is that life satisfaction does go up with income, but it goes up a lot more when you go from being a desperately poor country to being a sort of okay country than it does when you go from being sort of okay to being a rich country like the United States. Still, you know, I think if we really want to think about these issues, it's not about do people have the wrong taste, so they go for the wrong stuff. We want to think about how are we going to shape economic growth so that it is consistent with protecting the environment, so that it is consistent with a better planet. And you can do that. We don't have to be burning as much oil as we are. We don't have to be doing as much damage to the environment as we are. But that's mostly a question of getting the incentives right. So it's about policy. It's about getting environmental policy right. You know, philosophers have been lecturing people on the hollowness of materialism for thousands of years. I don't think they're getting anywhere.
Rahm Emanuel, Barack Obama, President-elect Obama's chief of staff, has been quoted saying, you know, never waste a crisis. The implication being use this crisis to push in a new direction, maybe a new agenda. Do you see that, including the kind of changes you're talking about right there on healthcare, energy, the works?
On healthcare, for sure, because it's legitimate. I mean, although healthcare – universal health care is a long-term policy, not a direct response to this crisis. One of the things that an economic crisis drives home is just how fragile, how unfair this system is. I've been trying to do some rough estimates of how many people will lose health insurance in this crisis. And it's not easy to do, but it's certainly going to be in the millions. And you know, why should a financial crisis on Wall Street, why should the misjudgments and bad faith of a few investment bankers lead millions of ordinary Americans to be unable to get the health care they need? So we can say that this crisis is a mind-opening event. It can push us towards understanding why a stronger social safety net is necessary. And the biggest hole in the American safety net, which doesn't exist in any other advanced country, is healthcare. Environment is going to be a tougher sell. I think there's a lot to be said. I mean, not a lot. Ultimately, nothing else much matters if we mm-hmm. ruin the planet. It's going to be harder to use this crisis to justify stronger environmental policies. I think that's something
– Because of the economic cost of such policies at a vulnerable time?
Yeah, and because the argument that I can make on healthcare that the crisis reveals to people, but it drives home just how much we need it. It doesn't do the same thing for greenhouse gas emissions, so the crisis doesn't point in that direction, and it is going to be hard. I mean, probably suppose we were going to do a carbon tax or the equivalent of a carbon tax mm-hmm. through cap and trade. Even an ardent environmentalist might say, gee, you know, right in the middle of this slump is probably not the best time to do that. So I don't think that which doesn't mean we can't pass legislation planning to do it, you know, not this minute. But I have to say that this crisis is a much more natural fit for a healthcare agenda than an environmental agenda. All that said, long answer to a short question, all that said, you know, it's also pushing us in a more progressive direction. The whole sort of business knows best, markets always work, government is always the problem, never the solution. That whole line of argument has been pretty thoroughly discredited by recent events, and that's going to help us on environmental policy in time.
Can I ask you about something that's still bugging me that factors right into that debate? There's a lot of particularly conservative perspective out there very strongly and consistently saying now, it's exactly government intervention that was at the heart of this problem, pointing at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the sort of hand of government in the housing market, which is behind so much of this, and saying if it weren't for the way these, you know, sort of quasi-governmental organizations warped the market, we would not be in this pickle. It's an argument made again and again, and it'll come back when the meaning of this economic crisis, you know, returns to politics again. How do you see, for the historical record, what happened here?
Okay. Now, no excuses for Fannie and Freddie. They were created in a fundamentally unsound way. They were quasi-private, quasi-public. You had stockholders making money while at the same time benefiting from what was perceived as a government guarantee. This was not the way you want to run things. And they did do some bad stuff. They did make some bad loans. They did behave badly. And they did some accounting shenanigans, which were certainly unforgivable. That said, if you look at this crisis, Fannie and Freddie were largely offstage when the bad lending that made the crisis possible took place, precisely actually because of those accounting problems. They were pushed into the background. They did very little of the mortgage lending from 2003 onwards, which is exactly when the housing bubble inflated to its gigantic height and exactly when most of the loans that are now going bad took place. Their loans, although they made more bad loans than they should have not gone bad at anything like the rate at which the private sector's lending has gone bad. So if you're looking at the crisis, if you just look at the numbers about who was holding mortgages, who was responsible for lending, Fannie and Freddie are manifestly, obviously, not at the core of the crisis. They were actually pulling back at the moment when things were going most off the rails. Should add, since this usually also says, well, Congress forced lenders to lend to these minority groups. That's also part of the story that the right is telling. And the truth of their matter there is that the Community Reinvestment Act, which everybody talks about, applied only to depository institutions, essentially traditional banks, and that's not where most of the lending came from. I think it's only one of the top 25 mortgage lenders was actually subject to that act. So this is a story that they're determined to find the government was the villain. And to do that, they have to completely ignore the facts about who actually made the bad loans and when.
Question for you from our website, onpointradio.org. Mr. Krugman, please discuss how the tax structure should be changed in order to help bring the new Gilded Age to an end, by which I guess our correspondent here is looking at income inequality.
Yeah. There's a fair bit you can do, although most of the surge in inequality has been in pre-tax income. But it's been exacerbated by a real reduction in the progressivity of taxes. So we've gone from – well, you know, if you go back to the days when that socialist Dwight Eisenhower was in the White House, the top tax rate was actually 91%, and now it's 35%. Now, most economists, myself included, don't think that a 90% tax rate is actually a good idea. But we certainly have sharply reduced taxes at the top end of the scale, which has made things worse. I'm not sure that you – yeah, let me say that reforming the tax code is not in itself going to be enough to bring us back to a middle-class society. But it certainly is a step in the right direction, and we have to get over this notion that if you tax rich people even a dime more, that somehow they'll all go away and refuse to do refuse to invest or be entrepreneurial. That if you require some CEO to pay 38% of his income instead of 35% of his income in taxes, he'll just quit his job and go home. We have a lot of scope for being more progressive again in taxes.
Obama has indicated he may put off those higher taxes for upper income groups while we're in this ditch. Are you with him on that?
I actually never thought it was going to happen anyway until 2010. I mean, legislatively, it's quite hard to change the tax code. The Democrats, unless Al Franken pulls it off and there's an upset in Georgia, are not going to have 60 seats in the Senate. So the great hope for rolling back the Bush tax cuts actually was the fact that Bush, for trying to hide the true cost of it, wrote it so that the tax cuts turned into a pumpkin at the end of 2010. So I never thought it was actually going to happen before 2011 anyway. And look, raising taxes in the face of a recession is not great policy, even if the tax cuts were very ill-advised when they took place. Ideally, we'd be able to completely restructure the tax code right now instantly and also in the process avoid having too great a tax increase, but that's too hard to do legislatively. So I don't have a problem with that. I don't think that's a major concession on Obama's part.
So we're looking maybe at Paul Krugman's enormous stimulus coming down the pike in an Obama administration. Do you have any doubt that the rest of the world, even now, and let's say China, that China will lend that money? You say, well, if you've got an advanced country with a stable government, historically people do it. But China has its own problems now. Is there any chance they just say, sorry, we kind of need this money to dig ourselves out of our hole?
But that's not where the money is coming from.
Hmm.
Remember, what we're doing is we're filling a hole in private demand. What's happening is that U.S. consumers are starting to save again because they're scared, and that U.S. businesses are cutting back on investment because they can't get the money and also because they're scared. So what's actually happening is that there's a great increase in the net savings of the private sector, the net cash flow from the private sector. Goldman Sachs is putting that at like 9% of GDP over the next year.
So we would finance our own stimulus program?
Effectively.
Really? Really?
Yeah. Effectively, what we're really doing is having government borrowing take the place of a collapse in private borrowing. It's not really new money from China. There's a misunderstanding here. Most of this is not new money. Most of this is just trying to get government to do the spending that right now the private sector will not.
But it's not Chinese buying T-bills at the bottom of that pile?
Not any. If the Chinese stopped buying T-bills entirely, that would be a major cutoff in capital flows. But we're not really, in the end, depending on the Chinese to finance this. No, it's really the world. It is our own increase in savings and decline in investment that's paying for this.
Well, I guess if it all goes that way, Paul, we'll see you on all those shiny new bridges around the country.
I want one named after me.
A bridge for Paul Krugman. Maybe take us to Brooklyn. The new book is, well, the revised version brought back is The Return of Depression Economics and the Crisis of 2008. Paul Krugman, it's always an education and a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Great to have you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.